Greetings, friends, and welcome to the Decaledge podcast, companion to the Decaledge blog. I'm Matt Boutte, your author and host. Today's guest is Dr. Khawaja Azamuddin. Khawaja is a surgeon in Houston, Texas, and is also the author of Boy Refugee, a memoir from a long-forgotten war, which details his time as a child in a POW camp following the 1971 India-Pakistan War. This is a wide-ranging discussion where we talk not only about his experiences, but also about mental resilience, compassion for other people, and the current global refugee crisis. I think this is an important and timely topic. So with no further buildup, please enjoy my conversation with Dr. Khawaja Azamuddin. Well, Khawaja, welcome to the Decaledge podcast.
Thank you. Thank you, Matt. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you. So we're obviously here to talk today about your book. But before we jump into the book, maybe we can spend some time setting the context. Tell me about Pakistan in the late 1960s leading into the early 1970s. What was life like for you, and what was life like just for the people living in those places at that time?
Yes, Pakistan in those days was divided into two parts. There was a Western wing and there was an Eastern wing. And, very surprisingly, and it might be of surprise to many readers, that this country, one country, consisted of two parts that were separated by almost 1,000 miles. So these were kind of two satellite places, and they chose to be called Pakistan, the East Pakistan and West Pakistan. I was born in East Pakistan to parents who were actually from the Western part. So it was a nice childhood. My father used to work in the jute mills. He was a manager there, and we lived in the staff quarters. And I have very fond and beautiful memories. It was a beautiful, lush green land, land of lakes, rivers, farms, and all sorts of greenery abounding around us. So I think my childhood memories of East Pakistan are those of a very quaint, peaceful place, as beautiful as heavens might be. And it was a very peaceful and loving place. The people were all very loving. And, this was my earliest memories of my childhood. I had a very happy childhood. I had two siblings, and my father was a manager in the jute mill. My mother was a school teacher. And we lived in a small community called Adamji Nagar, which was actually built around the mills where my father worked. So this was a very nice, peaceful community. And I love my time there, growing up there.
As beautiful and as good as that time was for you, there was some political turmoil. There was some strife among the population. Is that right?
Yes. Simmering underneath this peaceful, atmosphere was some problem going on. And as a child, I did not really understand the depth. I was just happy, playing with my chickens or pigeons and my friends and being with my cousin and family. I was just happy there. But underneath all that peaceful life was some trouble brewing. You see, we were from West Pakistan, and we lived in East Pakistan. And my father was in a very good position. And so were many of the West Pakistanis living in East Pakistan at that time, perhaps because they were more well-educated, so they got higher-paying jobs and were at the top of the society. Whereas the indigenous population, perhaps not very well-educated, and of course, they were the masses. So there were poor people among them, there were rich people, but a far greater majority did not have access to education, to electricity, to fresh water. And that over a period of many years led to a resentment of the local populace against the people who were from West Pakistan. Perhaps they were more educated, and perhaps that is why they had the higher paying jobs. But still, the vast majority of the population in East Pakistan lived in poverty, and they did not have the same facilities as were available to the few who lived in larger cities and worked in, you know, well-paying jobs. So yes, underneath all of that, there was quite a bit of resentment and simmering happening.
And that's a resentment that we certainly see, I think, anywhere there's an indigenous population, to use your term, and there's another group in power, right?
I mean, that is correct.
It's a common
thing. That is correct. And you are so right. Most of the high-paying jobs and even the government jobs were held by the West Pakistanis. And as I mentioned, they may have been more well-educated, but that was the fact. Whereas the poorer people did not have enough to live on. And so the vast majority of the Bengali population felt that the people in government, they were not really looking after the welfare of the common people. Perhaps their education was not being supported. Perhaps there were not enough factories or mills or opportunities for employment. So that started quite a bit of resentment. And when the West Pakistanis, there was a movement at that time that because these countries were separated, but they were still one, an idea came to the West Pakistanis that perhaps the language, the official language of the land, the entire masses should be Urdu, which was predominantly spoken in West Pakistan rather than East Pakistan. In East Pakistan, they spoke Bengali. And when the West Pakistanis tried to impose Urdu as the official language of this land, of the land of Bengal, of course, people felt that their culture and their identity was at stake. And that is probably what the final straw was, or one of the many final straws. And they basically revolted. They said, no, this is our culture is being taken away. Our language is being taken away. And the indigenous population was very upset.
I can understand. I suspect you probably can too.
I can. Certainly at this time, when I was young, perhaps I didn't really know all the nuances. But now certainly I can see that this was not right.
And so this underlying resentment, it builds. It builds on itself and reaches kind of a fever pitch, if you will, in 1970 into 1971. Why don't you talk now about kind of what happened then?
Yes. So in 1970, December 1970, there was an election. And during this election, the Bengali candidate, Mujibur Rahman, won the elections fairly and squarely. So he was an East Pakistani, and for the first time, he would be the president of the United Pakistan. And that just did not fit right with the West Pakistanis. And the West Pakistanis did not want to give up the power base, which has always been with the West Pakistanis. So after the election, negotiations started, the assembly was called in, but then it was delayed and things were just not going. It was clear that the West Pakistani military was not ready to give up the reins of the country. So they made excuses. So a few months passed by and the Bengalis felt that, no, this is enough. We have fairly and democratically won the elections, and we have the right to rule the country or to form the parliament. And that just did not happen. So the Bengalis said, no, this is it. We are not going to go along with this. And they started a liberation movement. And they said, no, we do not want to be with the West Pakistanis anymore, and we would separate. And that kind of made sense to many of us because, after all, these two countries or states were 1,000 miles apart from each other. So Bengalis wanted to go their own way. And I think totally justifiably so. Over the next few months, in March, April, June, a lot of violence started, you know, because things were not happening democratically. The Bengalis took to violence. And for them, it was their fight for independence. I mean, I call it a violence. Perhaps I shouldn't. I was raised as a West Pakistani. So that is perhaps why I am a little prejudiced in this. And I called it violence. But probably violence is not the right word. It was their struggle for independence. They demanded independence. The West Pakistani military cracked down with an iron fist. And they said, no, this is not going to happen. You're creating disturbance. And that emboldened the Bengalis even further. And really, by March, April, and May, within a few months after the elections, the whole country spiraled into a civil war.
March 71, how old are you?
I'm 8 years old.
8 years old. And so,
yes.
What does that feel like to go from this idyllic childhood to have a family that identifies as West Pakistani, and all around you is erupting civil war? What does that feel like to an 8 year old?
Very unnerving. I remember very vividly that, you know, there was kind of fear. A cloud of fear. My parents, my mother, I could sense it from my parents, my mother and my father, were very unnerved and very shaky. And of course, that trickles down to the kids. And we were very unsure, insecure. It seemed that our idyllic world had turned upside down because we had Bengali friends. We had Bengali people working in our house. They'd all left. And my friends were not coming out to talk to me. My Bengali friends, I'm sure, you know, the Bengalis wanted to keep to themselves. You know, neighbors became, I won't say enemies, but neighbors became strangers. And it felt as if we didn't know anybody in Bangladesh anymore. So it was very unnerving, very insecure kind of feeling.
Yeah.
Very worrying.
So then we end up with what's now more or less known as the India-Pakistan War of 1971, which until I read your book, I had no awareness of. And maybe that's just the American school system. Maybe I'm not well read enough, but I didn't know anything about that. And so if you would talk a little bit about that war, which doesn't last very long, and what comes of that?
As you can imagine, the two factions are fighting in India and the Bengalis and the West Pakistanis are fighting, and as a result, a lot of people became displaced from their homes and started pouring into the borders of India. India had a huge crisis with the refugees, straining its resources. India had been in pretty bad terms with Pakistan over the past many, many years. So both India and Pakistan had already fought two wars in 1948 and 1965. And there was a great deal of animosity between the two countries. So I think India saw this as an opportunity to create further unrest within Pakistan, and they supported the Bengali freedom fighters. One of their main reasons was that because India was being adversely affected by this refugee spillage into their boundaries, so India jumped into the war, and now we have three parties fighting. And it was really a free-for-all, a civil war. And the civil war really started by March, and in April, May, June, July, it grew further until by the end of November, it was very, very chaotic in East Pakistan. But the official war started on the 3rd of December, 1971. And that is when, the troops started clashing. The war was declared, and the war was really a one-sided war because most of the indigenous Bengali population was with the Indian Army who was attacking Pakistan. And I don't know if many of the listeners are aware, the East Pakistan was actually surrounded by India on the north, west, and eastern sides. So India attacked East Pakistan from all three sides, plus the indigenous population was fighting with the Indians. So it was really a one-sided war. The Pakistani army collapsed very quickly and surrendered on the 16th of December, 1971.
Yeah. And in that period of 1971, in the book, you talk about you and your family kind of travel back and forth once or twice between East and West Pakistan, wondering where should we be? Where are we going to be safe? But ultimately, you end up back in East Pakistan, right?
We did.
And so what was the result for you of that decision?
The one of the main reasons why we went back to East Pakistan, knowing all the trouble that was brewing there, the main reason was because my father's job and livelihood depended on it. My father thought about going back by himself, but my mother didn't want to separate our family and just live with this ordeal of having my father far, far away in a dangerous place all by himself. So my mother decided that we will all stay together. And that is why we went back to East Pakistan. This was in July that we reached East Pakistan again. And from there on, things really did not improve. They kept spiraling down. And really, there was no other option. We really didn't have much option at that time. We were kind of caught in the whirlpool beyond salvage.
But at least one of the results of that decision, and I can totally understand why your mother and father would make that decision, but one of the results ends up with your family in a POW camp.
That is correct. So once the war ended, we were the unwanted people. We were the West Pakistanis. And there was a mass massacre at that time, and many West Pakistanis were killed and, driven out of their homes. We escaped, and we stayed in a refugee camp. We escaped with the West Pakistani army. We stayed with them, and we were placed in a refugee camp. I have to kind of digress and tell you about these refugee support organizations and the wonderful work they do.
Yeah, please do.
When we really didn't have anything or not even a place to live, we had the privilege of being rescued by the UNHCR, United Nations Commissioner for Refugees, and IRC, the International Red Cross. And these refugee support organizations came in the middle of the war and provided us with refuge, with a place where we could stay. So we were taken to a refugee camp after the surrender of our forces. We stayed in the refugee camps for about 10 days or so. And from there on, we were moved to India. The idea being that since we were West Pakistanis, we needed to be transported back to West Pakistan. Otherwise, we would have been killed in East Pakistan or the then Bangladesh. So the Indian Army took upon the task of transferring these 93,000 people. There was a big number, 93,000 people to Pakistan or West Pakistan. And that is when my family became refugees. And since we were lumped together with the Pakistani armies that were officially the prisoners of war, we also were called prisoners of war. But officially, the technical terms is we were civilians under protective custody, CUPC. That was a number given to us and an identity given to us by the United Nations at that time. So then we were transported to India for our safe passage to Pakistan. And here is a very, very amazing story, you know, of humanity, I would say. Because remember, a few minutes ago, we talked about the Indians as being our enemy. But now that the war was over, they were actually our protectors. They were our saviors. Because had they not intervened along with the UNHCR, we would probably have been killed in East Pakistan by angry mobs. So the Indians took us, safeguarded us, and protected us, and then took us to these refugee or prisoner of war camps in India. So this is by an ironic twist of fate, and it's just an amazing story that the Indians did show us some humanity, compassion, and they actually saved our lives. So I think that is an important message that comes out of my story, that even your enemy is capable of great amount of good. I think that is the message that I learned from my story.
Yeah, that's a very, very important point. I think it's so easy for us to vilify the other.
Exactly.
Certainly, in the United States right now, we have a lot of that going on. But you're absolutely right. There's good in everyone, and
there is good in everyone. There is bad in every culture and society, and we just have to look for the goodness amongst our people.
Tell me, I mean, again, I keep thinking about the fact you're 8, 9 years old, and so they've taken you into India, and then you ultimately end up in a refugee or a POW camp. What is that experience like for you as such a young man when you walk into those gates?
I'll just give you a little background here. Now that we were in a refugee or POW camp in India, our next step was to go to Pakistan, to be transferred to West Pakistan. But that did not happen. Why? Because the two countries had just been at war and they were not talking to each other. There were no diplomatic channels open to negotiate our return. So things start dragging on and on and on. And we thought we would spend a few days in India and would be transferred to Pakistan. We actually ended up spending the next 2 years in that camp. So your question really is what transferred and how it was to live in that camp. It was quite an experience. Of course, we were surrounded by barbed wire fence. We lived in cages. These are big cages. I mean, in our cage, we had 840 people or so. We lived in barracks, and we slept on barren floors. There was really these were large barrack rooms, and in every room there were about 50 or 60 people living together, and maybe 8 or 10 families in each room. So there was really no partition or boundary, and everybody slept wherever they could. It was quite an experience. You know, I wish nobody has ever have to go through all of that. We just lived there for the next 2 years, not knowing what's going to happen next. So first of all, there was lack of basic facilities. For example, even toilet, bathing, cleaning, washing your clothes. We didn't have any extra clothes. We just lived with what we had, a few that we had brought in. Food was scarce. The living conditions were really, really tough, as you would read in the book. But also not just the living physical conditions, but also the mental trauma that most of us went through was not knowing what's happening tomorrow.
So let me interrupt, and I'm going to take a digression for just a minute. So Your book, Boy Refugee, is rich with detail about your 2 years in this camp. How do you have such a good memory for what took place there, given the passage of time and that mental trauma?
Yes. So I was blessed that I have some family members, some friends who I could tap on.
Okay.
And I got the information from there. But also remember, you know, as a young child, what happened in those days is really imprinted on my mind. I still very vividly, even though I was very young, I very vividly remember the grounds, my barrack, my room, where I used to run around or play.
Sure.
So these things just don't leave your memory. It's kind of ingrained in my mind forever.
Okay.
And then there were many other things that I did not remember. So my older siblings helped me. And then I went on and researched about this. And I met a lot of people who were in my camp or in other surrounding camps. I got a lot of information from other people that I included in the book.
Okay. And so to go back to your life in the camp, you know, you mentioned clothing, and the first thing that came to my mind was, you know, I have a young son. He's 11 years old, and it seems like I'm having to buy this kid pants about every 90 days because he's growing so much.
Yeah.
And so talk about, you know, you're in the camp and you essentially have the clothes on your back, and I think maybe a small suitcase or two, but you mentioned food is scarce and all of that. Where are you getting, are these refugee organizations providing you clothing, or how does all of that work?
Of course we came to the camps with perhaps maybe a couple of, pants or shirts, and that's about it. And I think our mothers became very good at mending and stitching these clothes back and making them new again. My brother, as he grew older, his clothes were handed down to me. And similarly, we exchanged clothes between other families as well. There was really no shop that you could go and buy clothes from. So I think people traded clothes between each other as their children grew up. They handed it down, something of that sort. Winters were a big problem. Winters were very cold, and we just did not have enough clothing or coverage to cover us. During those times, the Indian Army provided us with sweaters and these were like not regular sweaters. These were army grade sweaters. So I would be wearing probably a huge, big sweater. And they provided us with some blankets that we would wrap around ourselves. It was tough. A couple of times the International Red Cross also provided us with some clothing during this period of time. But during our camp life, I think the main charge of managing the camps rested with the Indian government. So I think the IRC and the United Nations did not have much input during our stay in the camps. Before the stay in the camps, yes, they were in charge of our well-being. But during these 2 years, I did not see much of them. So it was very tough, especially during the winters.
And one of the things that comes out in your book, though, is your life there, at least your life as a child, wasn't without happiness. Is that right?
That is true. You know, children being children, we will find happiness anywhere. So I had a group of friends, and we just, went out, played in the field. Ran around sometimes for no good reason. We would run around and chase each other. So, yes, children being children, we are happy. And really, the source of my satisfaction or happiness was my family. Had I been there without my parents, of course, it would have been a completely, completely different situation. Sure. But just to have my father and the mother there, and after playing around, I would come back and just be with my mother. So I think that was a very, very reassuring thing for me. I don't know how these days you hear about children being separated from their parents and all that in camps. And I don't know how that child can really go through that kind of trauma. I had trauma all around me. But as soon as I came to my mother's embrace, I had no worries in the world. So I think I was very happy and satisfied at that time.
You come to your mother's embrace and have no worries in the world, but let's underscore, you're in a barracks with 800 other people. And
yes, that is correct.
You know, I think in the book, you note your mother in particular, but your father as well, went to great lengths, I think, to make a sanctuary for your family on this concrete floor in these barracks. Is that fair?
That is absolutely true. Both my mother and fathers are the real heroes of my story. You know, they took it upon themselves to make sure that we, the three of us, did not feel intimidated or insecure. They put us within us the spirit that, hey, this is something we are going through. This is temporary. This too shall pass. And we just got to move around. Now, I'll tell you one thing, that not only did they provide emotional, mental support to us, but they also actually, I think this was the biggest gift that they gave to us, is that during our time there and even afterwards, my parents never talked ill about either the East Pakistanis or the West Pakistanis or the Indians. And they just left us with this legacy that, you know, we need to take people as they are, and there is only a little, so much blame that you can assign to one group of people or somebody. We just got to accept things as they are and move on in life. So I think that is what all three of us grew with. Yeah.
That's a great legacy to give your children, certainly. As parents, we often present a front to our children that maybe isn't completely true. How do you think your mother and father, between the two of them, dealt with this situation that was thrust upon them?
I can't even imagine how they coped with this situation. It must have been such heartbreak. And they were actually pretty well off, and they lived a very comfortable life. They were very well-educated people. We lived in a very large bungalow in East Pakistan, and now they were thrust into this situation where they had zero control over anything. And I even shudder to imagine what went through their minds. They did not talk a whole lot about what happened, and they probably just internalized it. I just have to salute them for what they went through, and they just accepted it. You know, there is a lot of people these days just kind of revolt, or they're angry at what happens to them. I think my mother and father were not bitter people. They were not angry people. And they just said, this is our fate. This is what has happened. We just got to make the best of the situation. And I think that's really their legacy. And that is what that is who they were.
Yeah, you use the phrase that many people feel like this is happening to them, which is a victim mentality, yeah. Right? But it doesn't sound, yes, like your parents ever viewed the world that way.
No, they did not. They felt that the situation was bigger than what, you know, they had control over. it was not under their control, and whatever happened, happened to other people as well. And we will live our life just as we are, and we are not going to blame anybody for our predicament.
Yeah, that's powerful. We're recording this on October 31st, 2020, almost to the day 47 years ago, I think. The story changes for you again.
Yes. So let me just build up the scene a little bit. In late August of 1973, almost 18 months after our imprisonment, we finally heard that we would be released. And our turn came on October 29th. On October 28th, we were put in a train, and that took us to the border between India and Pakistan, the Wagha border. And on the morning of the 29th of October, that is just the day before yesterday,
yeah,
we crossed the border, and it was a tumultuous, joyful feeling. You know, I was perhaps so young, I probably did not even understand the real meaning of what was happening, but I still remember that I was overjoyed and extremely happy and laughing and running around. So it was such a momentous occasion for all of the refugees. Almost 850 people crossed the border that day, and it was just such a joyous occasion for all of us.
Yeah, I think about the relief, the adults, the adults, your parents must have felt.
Absolutely. Their life was beginning once again after being abruptly halted for 2 years.
And so where did you all go from there? Because your life in East Pakistan is no more.
That is correct. There was no more of the same support system. There was no more job for my dad. So it was a difficult situation. In those days, unfortunately, there were not many refugee support organizations, as today we have many refugee supports. Well, not many. I mean, we have a few refugee support organizations. But in those days, there was no such thing as for rehabilitation. Of course, they supported us or they took care of us during the event. But after the event, there was no rehabilitation support. So we were kind of, you know, this is the only thing we got was a train ticket to the destination of your choice. So we got a meal. We got a free meal when we crossed the border. And after that, we were told that, hey, you can get a ticket, train ticket, and you go wherever in Pakistan you want to. Apart from that, there was no organized support. But we were fortunate enough that we had some relatives who took us in, and they gave us boarding and lodging for almost a year. These were actually very, very tough times, because now my father did not have a job. It was almost a year before he actually found a job. So once again, we were living hand to mouth, and we were living with some relatives who actually provided us the shelter as well as the food. But apart from that, really, there was nothing else. So fortunately, the schools were free in Pakistan. Mm-hmm. And myself and my siblings got registered in the school, and we started going to the school.
Okay.
And that's about it. So these are actually the 1 year following our repatriation was probably as tough as was our life in the camps.
I see. And so do you grow up in West Pakistan? Obviously, at some point you've come to the United States. How did that transition happen for you?
Yes, I did grow up in Pakistan. For the next 16 years, I was in Pakistan in city Karachi, in the city of Karachi. I went to secondary school there, and then after that, I went to college there. My mother placed all the emphasis on our education. All three of us, she made sure that all her kids got the highest education. And she really pushed us. What helped her really is that the education in those days, at least in the government public public schools, was all free. So my secondary education was free, my intermediate college was free, and then my medical school was almost free. Almost free.
Yeah.
So that's kind of unheard of.
Right.
And that really helped me get into the medical school and complete my education, which I completed in 1989. And then I went to England for further education. Now, remember, my mother's emphasis was that all her three children should have the highest possible degrees achievable in their field. So my brother is a structural engineer. My sister is a master's in home economics. And I went to England in 1990 to pursue further education. And once I completed that, I wanted to get even further qualified. So I came to the United States in 1995 to get further surgical training and education. So that is my journey.
Your mother seems like quite a force to be reckoned with.
Yes, a very strong one.
How do you think, or maybe you know, maybe you've talked with her about it, but how do you think your mother felt seeing you and your siblings go from this POW camp to the careers and lives that you've been able to build?
I think it was very rewarding for her, but in a way, she kind of knew it. I don't think she gave us any chance. She knew it, that this is how it's going to be. And she made it sure that it was for our benefit, because, you know, after all, if you can imagine coming from a refugee camp and growing in those circumstances, living hand to mouth for many years, the only salvation really is higher education. That is what she wanted to get for us, and she was successful in doing so. She was very proud of all of us.
I'm sure. How do you think we're all formed by the experiences of our lives? How do you think this experience that you've written so eloquently about, how do you think that's influenced and continues to influence your life?
I think even though I don't know, but I know that there are so many things that are ingrained in my personality that are a direct effect of my experience as a boy in the refugee camp. So I think the first message that I learned, and we discussed this, that, you know, we cannot be victims and we cannot really just blame somebody for our predicament. Yes, life is never fair. Life will bring a lot of curved balls at you.
Yeah.
I think we just got to stand straight and take it one day at a time and say that, well, this happened, I will move on. So that's message number one. Secondly, I think one of the things that you hear from my story is that when two people that were similar or part of a country were fighting each other, it was the Indian enemy who came to save us. Isn't that true? Such is life. You know, things change and you never know who would be your friend and who would be your savior. So it was our perceived enemy, the Indians, who actually saved us when we were almost certain to maybe even die from the hands of the angry mobs. And they actually treated us very fairly. And you will read from my books, you know, there was a Indian army commander, Colonel Harnam Singh, who was a, you know, very reasonable and compassionate man. He was in charge of the 6,000 or so refugees within the camps. A pretty compassionate man, and he treated us very fairly and did not necessarily put us through a whole lot of aggravation. So even the enemy or your jailer can have compassion. And then I don't know, many people, so that is another message that one has to see, that you can find goodness everywhere. And you just have to look for it. And perhaps, you know, that person will show compassion, mercy. And we are all humans. We are all capable of anger, hate, and aggression. But we are all also capable of love, compassion, and humanity.
And it depends on what you want to see in the world. Because it's undoubtedly true that there were people in the camp with you that did not have the same experiences that you've had.
Absolutely. And in fact, I had a lady who was in my camp, and she had some very bad memories of what transpired. And this is a very funny story that my conversations with her. So this young lady, who is about the same age as I am, and she mentioned that we were woken up in the middle of the night for counting, when you are in a camp, in a POW camp, there are a lot of tactics that can be done to disrupt the morale of the prisoners. Sure. And one of this is, for example, in the army camps, and it did happen that the prisoners would be woken up at 2 o'clock in the morning for counting, just to make sure nobody's escaped.
Yeah.
So that's a very traumatic, mentally torturing experience. So this lady told me that this happened very frequently, and it's a very bad experience that my family went through. And it was the same camp, and I did not have that recollection. So I went back to actually some senior members of our camp, and I asked them that, did this ever happen? And he mentioned it happened once in a period of 2 years.
Yeah.
So, you know, once is the recollection that this gentleman has. I have zero recollection, and somebody else has recollection that it was a recurring theme and kept happening again and again. So I think a lot of things are the truth, but also how we perceive things colors our perception of the truth.
I think that's absolutely correct. What motivated you to write this book now?
There were many reasons. Basically, it started with the idea just to get it out for my children and for my cousins, nephews, and aunts, and my own family. But as time went by, I thought maybe I'll print it. So that was one reason. Secondly, there was this refugee crisis that is going on in the world at this moment. Many of our listeners may not be aware that today the world has the largest number of refugees since World War II. So second largest in the history of the world. And today we have 70 million refugees in the world. Now, refugee is not a person who's just decides to leave his home. This is a person who has a normal job. He is a part of the society, and he's just told to leave or evacuate. He's forced to leave or evacuate his job, his livelihood, his land, his home. So it's not with their will, it's against their will. 70 million people are out of their homes. So I wanted to bring some attention to the refugee crisis in the world. We in America are very far away from what is happening in Europe or Asia. So we kind of really do not understand or know how desperate these people are, what are their living situations, how these people spend every day. So I wanted to bring some attention to the plight of these refugees by writing the book.
Are there ways, if listeners or readers of the book want to help with the refugee crisis, are there ways or organizations that you would recommend people pursue?
Yes, I have worked and known quite a few refugee organizations. Now, these are some of them are here in America, and they are doing the work of refugee rehabilitation. For example, in Texas, we have the Texas Refugee Services. They have branches in Austin, Houston, and Dallas. We also have here in Houston and Austin, the AMANA Refugee Services. These are the rehabilitation support organizations. Now, as we grow out, there are many organizations that are helping with refugees in Greece, in Rohingya, and other countries in Italy. And these are also very good organizations. But one organization that really comes to my mind is IRC, in the International Rescue Committee. They do a wonderful job. Of course, United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. All these are great organizations, and they are working diligently for the sake of these refugees. But I would also, I cannot just leave this topic by saying that without saying that if you know your local representative or your any government official, also please tell them that these refugees are normal people who have been driven out of their homes. The reason why I say that is that here in the United States, we actually in the last many years, we've turned a blind eye to the refugee crisis. Of course, there are many problems that we have here in America and they need to be sorted. But as the moral leader of the world, it also falls upon us to think or at least consider or support the refugees throughout the world. Because we are the leader of the world, and as the leader of the world, it becomes our moral obligation to help those refugees. Because right now, the intake of refugees into America has almost come to a halt. This is the time when there are most refugees in the world, and shutting our doors to any refugee really goes against the principles of being with the downtrodden people. So I think this is my request.
I was really struck in your book. There's a passage where you talk about how you all were hoping and praying that the United States would come to your aid, and there was nothing. And then, yes, you know, realize at the same time, well, that's the Richard Nixon Watergate scandal, and the country's embroiled in its own kind of self-inflicted problems. But what resonated for me was just there are people who are hoping that we're going to intervene and that need us to intervene.
The world looks at the United States as the leader of the free world. And being in that position comes with some responsibilities. So I think people expect the best from the United States. And this, you know, is kind of our moral obligation to the downtrodden people of the world.
I agree. Where can people learn more about you, more about your book? Where can they buy the book?
Yes. So I have a website, theboyrefugee.com, www.theboyrefugee.com. I also have a Facebook page by that name, and you can check out more information. On my website, there is a blog as well that you can follow. My book is available at Amazon. It's a very quick delivery within the these days, within a day, you will get the book.
That's right.
Then I have, it is also available at Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, and other online stores as well. So I invite you to please check out my book, read it, and I hope the audience will enjoy the book.
Yeah, we'll link to a lot of that down in the show notes for the podcast as well. As we wrap up here, are there any closing thoughts or other things that you want to share with the audience and with your readers?
I wish and hope that the world would, you know, see different people as, you know, people. We are all human beings. We really have the same emotions of anger, frustrations, but also compassion, love, and mercy. And as you said a little while ago, that, you know, in every nation and race and color and ethnicity, there are good people. And then there are people who may not be so good. And we all got to live together somehow. So I think, as you mentioned, we got to find the goodness amongst us.
Khawaja Azamuddin, thank you so much for sharing your story through your book. And thank you so much for the time that you've spent with me today. This has been a great, great discussion, and I'm grateful for your time.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Just a few quick things before you go. First, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please consider subscribing to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or Spotify. Commenting on or rating the show would be great too. You can also go to the website, thedecaledge.com, and sign up for our mailing list so you never miss an episode or a blog post. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can do it through the contact page on the website or via Instagram at @the_decal_edge. Special thanks to Taylor Weidman for producing the show, for the intro and ending music, and even for designing the Decal Edge logo. Want to experience more of Taylor's work? Check out his podcast, The Dharmadillo Podcast. That's it for now. We'll have another episode for you soon. Thanks, and God bless.